Thanks for joining us, and welcome to the Stonebridge Church Podcast. Here at Stonebridge, our goal is to lead people into a real, healthy, and growing relationship with Jesus Christ. If you'd like to join us live, we hold services every Sunday at 9:30 and 11:05 a.m. at 1 Stonebridge Church Drive in the Woodlands, Texas. We invite you to check our website out at gostonebridge.com and follow us on Twitter, where our handle is @SBChurch, and give us a like on Facebook at facebook.com/GoStonebridge. Grab your friends and family and join us for one of our three identical Christmas Eve services at 3, 5, or 7 p.m. This week, Pastor Steve teaches from our Christmas series, Return of the Magi. Here's Pastor Steve.
Christmas has changed, hasn't it? Times have changed, and you know, it's one of those things that we thought several months ago it would be good, since we knew the Star Wars stuff was coming out, to kind of play off of it and to talk about, not of course the return of the Jedi, but the return of the Magi, because there's this call that God has for us, you know, to be wise. And it doesn't just mean the amount of knowledge that we have, but how we see life and how we see the world. And I have to tell you, I remember the first time seeing Star Wars. You remember that? I mean, it was great because I was just sort of amazed at Star Wars. And there was that sound and that guy named Darth Vader, remember, whoever that was, which of course, you know, he's not real. It's just a fictional character. You know, he doesn't, you know, not really around. In fact, I mean, he's not that scary anyway, right? I mean, who could be scared of a guy that can't breathe properly and carries around a flashlight? I mean, you know, throat's getting a little tight. But, you know, besides that, you know, it's just not that big a deal. In fact, just as a reminder of it, you know, that he doesn't really exist. Say this with me. Darth Vader doesn't exist. Say that. Darth Vader doesn't exist. Of course he doesn't, but but the concept, evil, darkness, you know, we all know it does exist. In fact, it's been the struggle of mankind, you know, since mankind has ever recorded anything, is, you know, what do you do in that struggle? And will the struggle go on forever? Is there any end to that struggle? And that's you know, even in the future with Star Wars, it's the struggle goes on. So here's the question. I think it kind of haunts all of us. I think it's an important question to take a look at. And that is, you know, can darkness be conquered? It would be the same thing as saying, can evil be conquered? If you don't understand, or if you don't have this hope in who God is, this is what you do. This is what you hold on to. That one day, man will sort of evolve into a non-evil creature, right? Just only goodness. Or maybe we will somehow just, you know, educate ourselves into a non-evil or no darkness kind of person. I still remember a long, long time ago, Barbara Walters, who was, you know, just a fabulous interviewer and a very accomplished journalist. Long, long time ago, I remember some event had happened in the world, and she was on the air, and it just kind of caught her off guard. And she said, "Can you believe that things like this still happen in our day?" Now, I don't know if Barbara Walters is a believer or not a believer, but humanly, that's how you look at it. The hope that you have is somehow humanly, we will fix ourselves. Humanly, we will somehow become something else other than, you know, what we are, a people who struggle with both good and evil, with light and darkness, if you don't believe that there's a God. If you believe there's a God, God of the Bible, and you believe that God is personal and God that has, you know, he has his own plans and his own desires, you know, then it's a different story. It's a different way of looking at it, because you understand and you realize, I hope you do, that God is the one that makes the change. And God is the one that conquers evil in our lives. And we are still in that battle and in that struggle, and we are still those, if you're a believer, you're still one of those who holds on to this hope and this promise, and you see it a different way, and you become, in a sense, a light to the world. That people are like, where do you get that from? Why do you see life that way? And you're not caught off guard by the fact that terrible things happen. I know we live in a time right now where it's kind of like, wow, where did this come from? Terrible things still happen. And you understand that that is the world that we live in, because evil and darkness is still around. It will still be around. That's not where our hope is. In our hope is in God Himself. It's in Christ Himself. Does that make sense? I hope so, because otherwise, you know, we turn into, even as believers, just those who fret and worry and fall apart, you know, hoping in the wrong things. The same things that the world around us hopes will change it. If we fall into that trap, then what happens is we don't really offer anything different to the world around us. I want to take you to a little bit different direction for Christmas this time. My wife, she asked me even this morning, she said, "I hope you're not doing the same old Christmas story." So it's one of the, she said that, that she did. So, and you're not allowed to say that. She can say that to me, because that's still where I will go at the end of the day, back to that same place where she is. But I may not come to your house if you say that. So, you know, that's, she can do that. She can hit me with it. And I will tell you this, it's one of the wonderful things, actually, but one of the difficult things about doing what I do is making it fresh and new and taking a different look at it, because you know the Christmas story, most of us do, and all the elements in it, but taking a different look at it, I think it is fresh and new because of, you know, this year is different than the year before, and our situation's different, and every time the circumstances are different, the things that God say, that he says, you know, they all of a sudden take on a whole new light and a whole new meaning. So I want to take you to a little different start than you've probably ever had anyone do before as far as the Christmas story. I'm going to take you all the way back to the Old Testament, but I want to set it up with two statements, two fill-in-the-blanks for you. And the first thing is, it's kind of practical, kind of logical, you probably understand this, that darkness can never conquer darkness, right? You understand that. I mean, it just makes perfect sense physically in life. If you want to conquer darkness, you can't bring in more darkness. That's not going to conquer. That, you know, in fact, you won't be able to tell the difference in the new darkness and the old darkness. And that means evil cannot conquer evil. Well, there's a kind of revelation, isn't it? And doing the wrong thing cannot conquer doing the wrong thing. That's why Jesus even said, you know, overcome, you know, evil by doing what? Good, right. That's the only thing that can do it. And that's the second part, really kind of goes along with the nature of darkness, which I hope you understand. Darkness is really the absence of one thing only. Darkness is the absence of light. That's right. That's how you define it. It's a very simple definition. When light shows up, darkness is gone, because darkness is the absence of light. And this is why Jesus says, you know, you do good to conquer evil, because when goodness shows up, you know, evil is the void is filled. It sort of goes away. Now, understanding that, practically we understand that. It's actually the same thing is true as far as God is concerned, God's hope, God's promises, the things that God gives us to drive away the gloom and the darkness and the sense of lostness and the sense that, you know, it's never going to work out, that a lot of people carry with them. And maybe you're here this morning and maybe you carry that with you even this morning, which means it's a good thing you showed up, because that's the only thing that drives it out. And that feeling is the absence, it's the absence of light, it's the absence of hope, it's the absence of what is supposed to fill us, you know, so there's this void that's there inside of us. Here we go, Old Testament. This is the book of Isaiah, and just sort of set it up with you, for you historically. Isaiah is an Old Testament prophet. If you're looking at the Old Testament times, Abraham starts the nation of Israel, and then you kind of go through this, you know, transitioning time, the promised land, Moses, all these different things, and eventually you kind of come to this after the time of Judges to Israel's first three kings. They were the only kings of Israel as a whole nation, all 12 tribes together, because the 12 tribes lived in different areas and different parts. And there were eventually what were divided into the northern tribes, the upper part of Israel, and the southern tribes, which really was primarily just Judah. And all the other tribes were the northern tribes. And David came from Judah. Saul came from the northern tribes, Israel, and so Saul was the very first king. David was the second king, came from the southern tribes, and then his son, the third king, you remember his name? His name was what? Solomon, that's right. And he was the third king. After that, the kingdom is divided once again. They're at war with one another. And there are northern kings and southern kings. Never again are they united. And there's a real difference in the two kingdoms. The northern kingdom is often called in the Old Testament after that, then Israel. And the southern kingdom is just called Judah. You'll see some other names too as far as Jacob and other things pop up. But that's in general, they are divided. They war against one another. The northern kingdom has a harder time being true and faithful and holding to the promises and who God is. The southern kingdom was more of the remnant that held to those things, which makes sense, being the descendants of David. And as they went on through time, everything didn't work out real well, so that there were battles and wars and darkness came. And at one point, about 700 B.C., this is when Isaiah prophesies, the northern kingdoms are trying to find solutions for their problems, for their darkness and for their struggles and all the difficulties in their life. And they consider an alliance with Aram, which God said, don't do that, wouldn't be a good idea. They consider an alliance with Assyria, that is the new kingdom in where Babylon and Persia would be. The Assyrians come, and eventually the Assyrians conquer the northern kingdom. Actually do it twice, I think 733 and 722 B.C. And they take them captive, a lot of them, and take them away. But somehow, amazingly, the little southern kingdom remains for a lot longer independent, free. God continues to rescue them. Excuse me. And the prophets make it real clear. It's because they are more faithful to God. They hold to the promises. They don't let go. They stay true. And so even though they also struggled and God disciplines them, you know, they still remained true for a lot longer. So Isaiah is a guy who wrote about 700 B.C. In Isaiah's prophecies are a lot of words about the coming Messiah, who would be, you know, Jesus, even though Jesus would not come for 700 years. And so it's a long wait, you know, between the things Isaiah says. If you read them, you would look at it and say, well, I'm not sure Isaiah understood all that he was saying and writing. Absolutely. But, you know, this was God, you know, putting those things in his words. So you can go to first chapter of Isaiah, some things about the Messiah, the seventh chapter of Isaiah, things about the Messiah. And then we're going to look at the ninth chapter of Isaiah, also some things about the Messiah to come. But understand that those words are all about rescue. They're all about God's plans, about God's hope. And they're not about what Israel or what Judah would do to fix their own problems, or that the world around them would fix those problems, but that God himself, he would fix those problems. And that understanding and that holding to that would be a light, not only to Israel, but would be a light to the Gentiles, to the nations around them, that there is a living God and that he still cares, and he still perseveres with people. He still has plans. You know, I'm not supposed to go into this, but even the Old Testament, one of the most documented books in all of history. It's just amazing how it's been scrutinized and gone over. And so these things, you know, people say, well, you know, Isaiah, somebody changed these, wrote these about Jesus afterwards or something like that. When they went to Qumran and they found what are called the Dead Sea Scrolls, a bunch of caves in Qumran, what they found is Isaiah's scrolls completely intact from the worst, the most critical, historians would say, from 150 B.C., 150 years before Jesus. Most, the majority of scholars say, no, probably 300, 350 B.C. is when these were done. So that far before Jesus was around, we know these documents are intact and have these exact words in them, because when they compared them, no change, you know, virtually in the documents, in the words. And also, it's incredibly documented, these words of Isaiah. And yet at the same time, I hope that you grab hold of the fact that the power and the meaning of what Isaiah writes. Okay, I know you said, didn't want a history lesson, but I got to set you up a little bit. This is in the eighth chapter of Isaiah. God is speaking to Isaiah, and this is what he says to him. He says, for thus says the Lord spoke to me with mighty power and instructed me not to walk in the way of the people. He's talking about the Gentiles around him and the northern tribes who are putting their hope in these alliances and with the Assyrians who would eventually conquer them, thinking that's going to be our solution. Don't think that way. Don't look at life that way. The next verse he says, you are not to say, it is a conspiracy. I don't mean you can't ever use that word. I'm just saying for them, you know, he was saying in regard to all that this people call a conspiracy. And you're not to fear what they fear or be in dread of it. Do you catch that? It's a very powerful statement. They're in fear of a lot of things. They look to a lot of things as going to fix their life and fix their problem and conquer the darkness, you know, in their life. Economics, you know, education, what they look like, you know, how talented they are, how mighty their armies are. Not that those things don't matter and are not factors, they are, but that's still not what you're looking for. If that's what you're looking to, you're still going to be left in darkness. You're still going to be left empty because those things don't last. They don't hold up. They're not the answer. So don't look at life the way they look at them. Don't fear those things. Instead, it says, it is the Lord of hosts to whom you should regard as holy. He shall be your fear, and he shall be your dread. Now, it's not the same kind of fear when you're like, God is going to come in and destroy us, you know, because he's evil and he's destructive. It's the one thing that we don't want to do is offend God, because God is all powerful, and they understand he is all compassionate. But he's the one person that we look to, and the one person we would never want to offend, because he is the one that gives us the good things that we have and who watches after us. That's what he's talking about. That's who you're supposed to look to and who you're supposed to fear and dread. Then he shall become a sanctuary. When you look at him this way, now he is a safe place. He is a sanctuary. But he goes on to say, but both houses of Israel, he is a stone to strike and a rock to stumble over, a snare and a trap for the inhabitants of Jerusalem. So he's also given a warning. He's a sanctuary, but he's also, be careful. You don't want to be stumbling over him. And the next verse he says, many will stumble over them. Then they will fall and be broken. They will even be snared and caught. Incidentally, these verses are quoted in the New Testament regarding Jesus several times also. Even Peter goes back to these verses and reminds us that Jesus is a stumbling block for some people. Bad way to stumble, because he's supposed to be our rescuer. The next verse he says, bind up the testimony. That means these words, this understanding, what you have learned, you hold it tight, seal the law among my disciples, and I will wait for the Lord who is hiding his face from the house of Jacob. Because, see, they can't see him. They don't understand. I will even look eagerly for him. And in verse 18, behold, I and the children whom the Lord has given me are for signs and wonders in Israel from the Lord of hosts who dwells on Mount Zion. So what he's saying is, you bind these, you hold these, you believe these things, and what happens is you become a sign and a wonder in your generation. You become someone that people look to and say, wow, where did they get that from? Why don't they fear and dread the way I fear and dread over the circumstances that are happening around the world? Why aren't they freaking out, you know, when things don't work out the way we want to? Where are they getting this from, you know? Do you not understand this is all that matters? Today is the only thing? Where do you get this hope from? And see, that's a word for the church today, for the believers today, that you are in this world, in one sense, to be a sign and a wonder to the people around you. Where do you get that from? Why would you still have a joy in your heart in the midst of these struggles? Why wouldn't you say, this is the only thing that matters? This is the worst that, you know, why wouldn't you look at life that way in circumstances in life? Well, because you understand the battle still goes on, good and evil will still struggle, it still exists, darkness still, but you know what drives out the darkness? What drives out the darkness? What is it? That's right. And that light becomes a hope inside of you. And that light changes the way you view everything. Because you see those things as just temporary. You work at them, absolutely. It doesn't mean that you don't fight and defend at times, absolutely, but you understand the one thing that I don't want to happen is I don't want to become like that with no hope. I don't want to become like that where I have become dark in my understanding. I've lost understanding of who God is and what He's, you know, what He calls us to and the faith that He calls us to, you know. Compassionate God, loving God, who has plans. He'll work out those plans. So he goes on to say, next verse, when they say to you, consult the mediums and the spiritists who whisper and mutter, and it's kind of an idea of that's where you'd find real wisdom, you know, in their day. Should not a people consult their God, he says? Isn't that a great word? Should they consult the dead on behalf of the living? Wow, big contrast. Would you go to the dead things of life to learn about life and living? Absolutely not. It'd be God that you would go to. In verse 20 says, the law and the testimony. Now this is a reference. Gotta remember, this is Isaiah, Old Testament. You know, he hasn't had, you know, the rest of the Old Testament, the New Testament. Even a lot of people know about the Jewish nation because of what has happened with Christianity worldwide as it has flourished. Gotta remember who he is. So they call it the law and the testament, or the testimony, because this is what he understood as what had been written and given to him up to this time. So he's saying you hold to what God has said and the promises that God has given you up to this time. And he says if they do not speak according to this word, in other words, if it doesn't match up to this, then you understand it is because they have no dawn. They have no, another word for dawn would be in the middle of the night. Dawn comes and they have no what? Light, yeah. They're just stuck in the darkness. They know no way around the darkness. They have no light, but see, what we've been given, what we've been told, gives us light. We know the dawn is coming. We know that the day is coming when God resolves it. And then he goes on to say, they will pass through the land hard-pressed and famished, and it will turn out that when they are hungry, they will be enraged. In other words, when they can't find satisfaction, and curse their king and their God as they face upward. It is a picture of looking for the light and looking for the dawn and seeing nothing. And so they even curse God himself because they have no hope. And then the next verse says, then they will look to the earth and behold distress and darkness, because that's where they look for an answer now, and a gloom of anguish, and they will be driven away into the darkness, hopeless. I mean, just an awful picture of man without God and without his promises and without his insight and the light that comes from him. But Isaiah now, ninth chapter, will turn and will address the remnant, Judah, that is going to be left. He's saying this even before the northern kingdom is conquered, and he addresses them. And this is the part you will recognize some verses in, because it's what the part we love and we hold to. Ninth chapter, he goes and says this. Incidentally, let me go and fill in the blank for you. This next verses have everything to do with the fact that discipline is not the same as darkness. Darkness is hopelessness. Discipline is the one who loves you and who disciplines you. And even though they discipline you and you feel kind of hopeless at the time of the discipline, you know and you understand this is because they're trying to give me hope. This is for correction. And so the southern kingdom, Judah, would be disciplined, but disciplined to correct them and to give them hope, right? If you're a parent, isn't that what you do with your kids? Do your kids like when they're disciplined? I think in the New Testament, it says that none of us like discipline, right? Oh, man, because it points out your mistakes and your faults, and there's a type of anger that seems to come from it. But because you know the one who disciplines you, loves you, and has compassion for you, you realize this is for my correction. And later you look back and you're thankful for the discipline because it changed the direction of your life. I know if you're you know, child here, you're like, no, I don't like that idea. Yeah, I understand, you know, but that's what parents do, and they do it for that reason. In fact, it's one of the things I, you know, always was kind of amazed about my kids, because Joni and I, you know, we disciplined our children, hard times, you know, hard things at times, but we did it because we wanted them to be on a certain path and have a certain hope and belief. And so we knew that was important for them. And what always amazed me is when my kids would do things that they knew, you know, would not please us, and they would come to us and tell us these things, knowing there's going to be discipline, not going to be pleasant, but knowing, but these are the ones who love me. These are the ones who have my best interest in mind. Or as I have told my son and my daughter both, I'm your greatest fan. I am. And that's why I will do these things. Because I pull for you like no one else. Well, actually, you have a Father in heaven that pulls for you more than I do. But, you know, here on earth, there's no one that pulls for you more than I do. So because of that, I can't overlook, you know, things that I know could lead you in the wrong direction or could harm you. You have to do this because you love your kids. You have compassion for your kids. That's God, right? God does not discipline us to destroy us or to take away our hope. It's the opposite, so that we wouldn't put our hope and our trust in things that we should not hope in, that could never give us hope, that would only let us down. He corrects us so that we would hope in things that are eternal and things that matter. And that's what a loving parent, you know, would always do. So this is what it says in chapter 9. But there will be no more gloom for her. He's talking about now the southern kingdom, who is in anguish. In earlier times, he treated the land of Zebulun, meaning God, and the land of Naphtali with contempt. That means because of their lack of discipline doing the right thing, boy, he is correcting them. But later, he shall make it, say this with me, he shall make it what? The land glorious. That means, man, he is doing this for a reason. He is filling it with light and with insight and everything about who he is, because he has plans for it. By the way of the sea, on the other side of the Jordan, and here's one of those again, you know, I have to do with who Christ would be, Galilee of the Gentiles, which is where Jesus actually, you know, grew up. So it's, you know, it is a prophetic word of what it would happen. So this one, it goes to say, verse 2, the people who walk in darkness will see a great light. Those who live in a dark land, the light will shine on them. Verse 3, he says, you shall multiply the nation. You shall increase their gladness. They will be glad in your presence as with the gladness of harvest. So, you know, you work all year, you plant, you pull weeds, you go through all that hard work, and the harvest comes in, you're like, yeah, it was worth it, right? Everything that we went through, everything that was tough and difficult, man, it was worth it. The harvest is in. Or as men rejoice when they divide the spoil. It means you're in conflict, you're in a war, and it's difficult, and the war is harsh. But at the end of it, when you win, you know, the battle and it's all over, you go like, yes, it was worth it because of the change that occurred in the end is here. Verse 4, he says, for a child will be born to us, a son will be given to us, and the government will rest on his shoulders. You know what this means? Jesus will rule all mankind, the world, the universe, forever. Now, he's not at that final point yet. He will rule forever. You know, there's a day coming. And his name will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, and I love this one, don't you? And what? The Prince of Peace. Man, does that talk about light and driving out the darkness and things being better? And these are just names that are attached to him. In fact, you know, really, someone should write a musical about this, you know, and put orchestration to it and all that, because this would be great. You know, you could call it like the Messiah. And it, I mean, these are just wonderful. Okay, y'all didn't catch it. Okay, sorry about that. Thought you'd get it. Incidentally, this phrase, because sometimes people ask things which are good questions, Eternal Father, it's called in English, this would be called an idiom, Eternal Father. You know what an idiom is? I know you say, yeah, I live around them, you know, all the time. I mean, no, idiom, it ends with an M. An idiom is a phrase or word that has its own meaning. So it's not saying that Jesus is the Father. It's referring to his eternalness, his lastingness, that he was before time began, he will be after time began. And it kind of has its own context to itself in this phrase. Then he goes on to say in verse 7, there will be no end to the increase of his government. That means he'll rule forever. Or his peace. On the throne of David and over his kingdom, to establish it and to uphold it with justice and righteousness from then on and forevermore. And I know you think, wow, how in the world can this happen? And he goes on and says how this happens. It's the zeal of the Lord of hosts that accomplishes this. This means God is so passionate about this. God is so determined that this is what will happen, that nothing will stop him. He is so zealous for this that it will occur. That's what Christmas is all about. They waited for 700 years. Didn't even necessarily know exactly what it would look like when he came. And wise men do come from the east, foreigners, Gentiles, those who are not even a part of the Jewish faith, would come seeking him because of some strange star and some unusual knowledge that somehow had been handed to them, maybe during the time of Daniel's captivity, and they come looking for the king, for the king of all Israel, of all Judah, even though it stirs everyone else up, and they're listening, and even when those wise men are warned, don't go back the same way. Don't consult what you consulted before. Don't trust in what you trusted before. They realize, not going back that way then. All changed. Everything is different because of what we understand. See, that's what Christmas is all about. And for the believer, man, this is what Christmas means. Light has come into the world. And it changes everything. You don't see life the same way. Not saying that other things are not important. They are important. But not as important as this. Not in light of this. There was a lady years and years and years ago, friend named Cynthia Clawson. Anybody ever heard Cynthia Clawson sing? Wonderful, incredible voice. She had red hair. It's one of the reasons I liked her so much. I used to have red hair. And hers is still red. I don't understand that. But they tell me women have a way of doing that, but I don't understand. Mine has faded away, and hers is just as bright red as it was before. And Cynthia, I remember one time, she came walking into a sanctuary. It was in a morning worship service, probably about 1,200 people there, and just walked up. No music, no accompaniment, no nothing. She just walked up, and it still, I really remember this, just hit me, just struck me. And she sings a hymn. The words are a good 300 years old, maybe older than that. She sings these words. This is what she sang. She walks up and says, oh, come, Emmanuel, and ransom captive Israel that mourns in lowly exile here until the Son of God appear. Rejoice! Rejoice, Emmanuel shall come to thee, O Israel. I was stunned because the response was just like this, complete silence. I thought, man, if Christmas could just be that way. We could just take everything else away and be reminded of just this one thing. That God will ransom us. He will rescue us. Our hope is not in ourselves. Not in the things that we can devise or the things that we can do. But our hope is in the God of the universe who gives his son. Jesus becomes our rescuer. This is how John writes it. This is in the Gospel of John. It's not going to pop up on the screen. If you have a Bible, if you want to look at it, it's 1 John. This is how he says it. Listen to these words. This is really amazing. John writes, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. All things came into being through him, and apart from him, nothing came into being that has come into being. In him was life, and that life was the light of men. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness did not comprehend it. There came a man sent from God whose name was John. He came as a witness to testify about the light, so that all might believe through him. He was not the light, but he came to testify about the light. There was the true light, which, coming into the world, enlightens every man. He was in the world, and the world was made through him, and the world did not know him. He came to his own, and those who were his own did not receive him. But as many as received him, to them he gave the right to become children of God, even to those who believed in his name, who were born not of blood, nor of the will of the flesh, nor of the will of man, but of God. And the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. And we saw his glory, glory as of the only begotten from the Father, full of grace and truth. We're going to celebrate what he did for us, remembering that Jesus Christ came in this world and it made all the difference in the world. So let's pray together. Heavenly Father, we thank you. You had plans long before mankind even understood what the real problem was. And even in the midst of our confusion and chasing after the wrong things and looking for answers that aren't really answers, God, you were determined to bring light into our world, to change us, to point us back to a relationship with you, an understanding that you are loving and you are compassionate, you are personal, you care. And that being rescued and being brought back to you would change everything. It would give us a reason to live, a witness in this world, a different way to approach our struggles and our problems and our difficulties, a different hope that would enlighten those around us. If you're here this morning and you've never believed, you've never put your hope and your trust, and that God loves you, and that God would not leave you without a rescuer, but instead he sent his Son into this world, who gave his life so that you could be changed, so that you could be set free. Oh, we thank you for all you've done for us. In Jesus' name.